I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Any real estate developer will tell you it's not what you build that matters, but where you build it. Location, location, location. And it seems that is just as true in death as in life. You buy your loved one a tomb with a view, and then along come the developers with a plan for a high-rise mausoleum right next door to your dearly departed. So, what do you do? Well, if your name is Helmsley, as in Leona Helmsley, the hotel heiress billionaire known as the Queen of Mean, you sue the cemetery for $150 million. After all, no one dared to build an apartment block for the dead next to the Egyptian pharaohs or to the Medicis of Renaissance Italy. And she sees no reason why her late husband Harry should be treated with any less respect. So maybe death is not the great equaliser that we thought it was. Is class warfare alive and well in the nation's cemeteries? What do you want for when your time comes? And will it matter to you who your neighbours are and what their accommodations are? Your thoughts on class and death. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining us now from our home in Brooklyn, New York, is Andrea Pazer. She's a reporter with the New York Post, and she's been following the Leona Helmsley story. And from Dallas, Texas, we're joined by Barry Boudreau of J. Stewart Todd Architects. That's the firm that designed the public mausoleum that's right next door to the Helmsley one. Andrea, I want you to paint a picture for us, first of all, if you would. We're talking about the Woodlawn Cemetery, one of the biggest in New York, full of famous people. What's the Helmsley Mausoleum look like?
Yes, this is I guess in New York terms, it's a fabulous cemetery. It's located in the Bronx, oddly, but when it started in 1863, it was pretty much the country up there. Of course, the Bronx grew up around it. Inside, you'll find people like Fiorello LaGuardia, a lot of magnates, Celia Cruz, the salsa legend, just got buried there this year. Anyway, the Helmsleys built a mausoleum. It is on a plot of land over 2,000 square feet. Now, that might not sound big to suburbanites, but for New York, that's quite a piece of property. They bought it in the 70s when it was at the lowly price of $59,000 for that piece of land in the Bronx. And they built a mausoleum. It's quite lovely. It's granite on the exterior. Inside, there's pink marble. And what makes it stand out is that on three sides you have stained glass renderings of the New York City skyline. Very prominently featured is the Empire State Building, which, as you may know, Harry Helmsley, you know, the late husband of Leona Helmsley, was instrumental in building, and she retains part ownership of this building. So that's what their mausoleum looks like.
Okay, now it might sound a little odd to talk about the view from a mausoleum, but does it have a good view?
Not anymore.
Did it have a good view when they built it?
Well, as it was described to me, it overlooked an empty green field. Now, beyond the field, of course, is the Major Deegan Expressway, but right in front of it was a green field. It was gated off, and according to Mrs. Helmsley, I'm not her spokeswoman, of course, but according to Mrs. Helmsley, she was given some sort of tacit assurances that that field would remain that way.
Now, her complaint is what, precisely? That the view has been destroyed?
That's part of it. She claims that she was not given appropriate notice, or any notice, frankly, she claims, and she feels that her agreements were violated. All these crypts that will now be in front of them. You see, you got to understand, it was like it's sort of like you live in a suburban neighborhood, in death, of course, and all of a sudden somebody builds a housing project. So we're talking about, I think I read 5,000 tombs, or lawsuit claims 10,000 tombs. So somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 people will be there. And then, of course, all the traffic. She's complaining about traffic and visitors and so forth and so on. So that's what her complaint entails.
You've spoken to her, I think, about this. She didn't want to speak to us on the show today. Do you think she has a point?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I don't know what kind of agreements she entered into. In 1978 was when she bought her piece of land, or you buy the burial rights, you see. And she bought the burial rights on this spot of land in 1978 for $59,000. I don't know what kind of agreements she was given. There is no mention of written agreements, So oral agreements. I don't know also if she's entitled to more notice on this, but I do know that as soon as she filed her lawsuit, she entered into negotiations for actually moving her mausoleum within the same cemetery to a different place where perhaps she wouldn't feel so crowded. And that broke down because there really isn't much room there anymore to build such a big mausoleum. Woodlawn is very crowded now.
She has a reputation as a lady who is careful with money. She's suing for $150 million. Is the money the thing, or do you feel she is genuinely upset at what has happened?
I feel she is genuinely upset. I mean, for anything you might want to say about Leona Helmsley, she adored her husband. She feels slighted in this case, and she feels that wrong was done to her. This is her allegation, and that's what prompted the lawsuit.
Do you think also part of it might be that she feels that there was something exclusive about the cemetery neighborhood, and that exclusivity has now been destroyed?
Perhaps. I mean, her lawsuit really compares it to one of the, I guess, one of the original mausoleums being one of the seven wonders of the world. I mean, she's in very good company there. She's a very prominent, famous people there. She's sort of on mausoleum row.
She doesn't like the new neighbors, in other words.
Pardon?
She doesn't like the new neighbors.
I would imagine so, but also maybe just the sheer number of them. That's been the controversy about these mass crypts, is that there are so many people there. You know, it's a different kind of mourning. Rather than, you know, you go to a cemetery and you're sort of you and maybe a handful of other people visiting graves and so forth. This, here we're talking about potentially busloads of people coming in and to mourn their dead ones. And I suppose if you're used to that kind of exclusivity and solitude and quietness in your mourning, you're not going to want to see, you know, I don't know, the bus from Atlantic City coming in.
Let's turn then to Barry Boudreau from J. Stewart Todd Architects. That's the firm that's built this new public mausoleum in Wood Lawn Cemetery. Barry, you've ruined the neighborhood.
So it would appear. That's certainly not true. We took great pains to design the mausoleum to complement not only the existing single-family mausoleums that are in the area, but also, and it should be pointed out, that we are directly adjacent to an existing community mausoleum, the Van Cortlandt Mausoleum, that has been there since the 1960s and has been added on a couple of times since then, as well as being catty-corner right across from Mrs. Helmsley's mausoleum as well, is the Lotus Mausoleum, community mausoleum.
Just spell out for us the size of it, would you? I've seen different descriptions of just how big this new one is.
The building that is under construction right now will contain about 2,300 crypt spaces. Uh-huh. And then about 100 cremation niches. So,
and how high does that go, if we're talking about views here?
Well, in terms of the bulk of the building, is about 17 feet in height. It's a one-story structure. In fact, on the website, I did notice this morning that it talked about a six-story structure.
Yeah.
We talk about six levels of crypt spaces. Those crypt spaces are only 2 foot 5 inches tall. So overall, our entire construction, again, the bulk of the building is about 17 feet tall, which is no more than, a common one-story residence. And then there are some atriums and some towers that do get as high as about 25 to 30 feet, but those are just spread throughout the building, and they're not the entire bulk of the building, certainly.
Okay, so 2,300 spaces available, potentially then over a period of time, 2,300 families who will wish to come and visit their departed relatives. That is going to create a different kind of environment, a different kind of neighborhood to the one which the Helmsley family anticipated.
Perhaps yes, perhaps not. The property is the mausoleum is built on about an acre and a half of property on a corner, on a very busy corner of East 233rd and Jerome Street, a very busy intersection with the Major Deegan, you know, in the backdrop. That parcel of property, even staying green, if you take the acre and a half and you figure, you know, about 1,200 ground burials in an acre would house 1,800 ground burials. So the difference between the ground burials and what we're going to be doing with the mausoleum is not tremendously different.
Just help me with one thing, if you would, Barry. If I have a family member who is in a crypt on level six, on the highest level, it's way above my head height.
Yes, that's correct.
How do I go and pay my respects?
Generally, when in a lot of how you price a mausoleum, obviously more closer to the heart, which would be the lower levels, are more expensive. And then as you get to the higher levels, the cost to the consumer drops somewhat. Those memorials are based either on just experiencing the space, which is why this particular mausoleum contains three atriums. They give you a place to sit and meditate. But really, if you are purchasing on the fifth and sixth levels, let's say, it's not for people that actually want to, you know, to touch the crypt front and actually make the physical connection. It's more for people that want to make the spiritual connection, just being in the same building with their loved one.
Now, this extends way beyond Woodlawn Cemetery in New York, doesn't it? I mean, these things are being constructed everywhere. I mean, do you sense, as a company that specializes in this form of construction, that there is a growing demand for them?
The demand is actually somewhat leveled. It depends on the area of the country. Certainly out in California, where you know land is sky high, much as it is in New York City, to try to maximize the number of burials on a given acreage of property, it behooves a cemetery owner to try to maximize density, obviously. Elsewhere in the country, for instance, the Midwest, the Gulf South, where land is plentiful, mausoleums then become more of a personal choice as opposed to an economic choice.
But it is cheaper to be to buy a crypt space in a communal, in a public mausoleum, than to buy one of your own.
And a single family mausoleum, yes. Mm-hmm. In terms of a match to a ground burial, it really depends on the area of the country. In some areas, it's very competitive. In other areas, it's actually more expensive to be buried in a community mausoleum than it is to be buried in the ground.
We're talking, though, about what is, I don't know how to put it, the death equivalent of affordable housing.
To a degree, yes.
And is it a kind of a way of giving people who are not particularly wealthy themselves the opportunity to have something which approximates to what in the past was available only to those with a lot of money?
That's part of it. Also, you know, a very large part of it is convenience. Most of these mausoleums do contain interior spaces, and it gives the family a place to get out of the elements, you know, at a time in their life when it's a very difficult time to begin with, and you don't have to be standing out in the rain, you're not standing out in the snow, you know, down here in Texas, you're not standing out in the sun. So it does offer a level of convenience, as well as offering the opportunity to be surrounded by marble and granite, bronze, you know, things that perhaps the average person would not be able to afford in a ground burial situation.
And when you look at the Leona Helmsley case, do you think it's about class?
I don't really know that much about the lawsuit, other than just basically what Andrea had talked about. You know, that site has been open. I would not necessarily have called it a green field. It was an abandoned entrance to the cemetery from years ago, and had an asphalt road down the center of it that was taken up as a part of this project. And we really had lost only a couple of trees, neither of them very major specimens in putting the project out there.
Barry, thanks for that. Barry Boudreau from J. Stuart Todd Architects, Andrea Pazer from the New York Post. Thanks to both of them. We're talking about class and death. 1-800-423-825 is the number. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This hour we're discussing social hierarchy in America's graveyards. My guests now are going to be with us for the rest of this hour: Gary Lederman, who's Associate Professor of American Religion and Culture at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's joining us from there. His latest book is called Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 21st Century America. Also joining us from his home in Norwalk, Connecticut, Xavier Cronin, former contributor to trade magazines like Funeral Director and American Cemetery, co-author of the book Going Out in Style, The Architecture of Eternity. Thank you to you both for joining us on The Connection. Gary Lederman, being buried above ground, being buried below ground, are we changing?
We're changing a bit. There are a lot more options than there were in the past that really focus just on interment in the ground. In America, that's been the favored way to go. But in the recent past, there are now a variety of other options, whether you're above ground, below ground, shot out into space. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities.
And do you see any hierarchical elements, any class elements in the kind of difficulties that we've just been discussing at Woodlawn, exclusivity versus public access?
Oh, sure. And I think that, again, has a long historical tradition. As you were saying at the opening of this episode, the necropolis mirrors the metropolis. I mean, the social kinds of tensions that exist in living society, believe it or not, can also be found in the city of the dead.
Xavier Cronin, you look at these kinds of things. Do you see class rearing its ugly head?
Well, it's really a story about the diversity of the U.S., and in this case here you have an extremely rich person who has a very elite cemetery space, and they take it upon themselves to sue to prevent this communal mausoleum from going up. So I think on one level, in any particular city in the U.S., you will have a stratification based upon socioeconomic factors. So I don't know if it's in terms of class, like the guy Barry before us was talking about. A lot of it comes down to dollars and cents. If you have extra money and you want really nice granite, then you'll get it. If you can't afford that, it's a nondescript concrete box that's slid into the wall. And what you mentioned about the layers, I mean, I've been in quite a few mausoleums when I covered this industry back in the 1990s. I mean, basically, the higher up, the less expensive for that very reason,
right,
that you said. So it's really just a matter of the stratification of the American population based on economics.
Gary.
Could I just add to that? It is about dollars and cents and the economics, but it's also something more. It's not just that. I mean, clearly, there is a religious element to this. I mean, we want to make sure at the deepest levels of our being that the dead rest in peace. I mean, they don't generally, but this is an issue for her, clearly. As well as earlier the architect talking about the space within as being a kind of sacred or spiritual space. I mean, it is about there are religious kinds of connections to the dead that are important.
We're curious to know what our listeners think about these issues, how much it matters to you, how you're buried, where you're buried, who your neighbors are. Give us a call, the number 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Xavier, Andrea Pays of the New York Post used a rather nice little phrase. She talked about Mausoleum Row, as in Millionaire's Row. If you had a family mausoleum, that set you apart. It meant you had something that the common folk didn't have. A communal mausoleum, a public mausoleum, which anybody can buy into, ruins the whole kind of idea, doesn't it?
Well, it ruins the idea of the community being representing the cemetery.
Well, the idea that I can afford something you can't.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, there's no secret here. If what the Mr. Letterman said, that was a very good point in terms of there's a religious aspect, but the bottom line is this is about what type of burial space can you afford? And if you have tons of money, the sky's the limit. But, I mean, in terms of ruining the idea of a communal, the idea of the cemetery as a community of the dead, of course. I mean, you go to some of these elite cemeteries that we wrote about in the book that you mentioned, mm-hmm. Doug Keister, the photographer. Basically, the rich and famous capitalists of the mid to late 19th century, it was an ego thing, and they were outdoing themselves with these extraordinary funerary statuary and mausoleums, you know, from California to the Northeast U.S., New Orleans, Chicago. I mean, absolute extraordinary architecture. And so that's exactly what it is. If you go to a cemetery right there in Boston, like Mount Auburn, they have fairly small family mausoleums, but they're still, you know, beautiful stone buildings, and inside there's altars. And, you know, a few feet away is, you know, a nondescript headstone, you know, Joe Blow. And so you're absolutely right. It's very much a stratification.
Gary, I'm curious about the religion in all this, because in many major religions, if you're looking at Islam or at Judaism or Christianity, the tradition is that the body goes in the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes. It was only the kings, the queens, the very special, the very rich, who could afford or could be permitted not to do that.
And in the case of certainly in Christianity, the issue was not so much economic stratification, but more the political hierarchies of the church, who got closest to the altar, and then, you know, that was a position of power. So it is economics, but it also does speak to divisions of power in society that exist generally. The fact that we live in a democracy instead of ancient Egypt or medieval Europe also is a factor, you know, in the sense that people all should be have equal access to certain kinds of methods of disposal.
And do you think that is one of the reasons why over a period of time the idea of mausoleums above ground, in which the remains are left above ground, seems to be growing in acceptability and in popularity?
Well, as the previous speaker was mentioning, this has been a trend for a while, especially since the 19th century and what were are described as the rural cemetery movement, where you would have people really who could afford it to build these above-ground mausoleum and have their bodies encrypted rather than interred in the ground. And so that's always been a status symbol, I think, except for a place like New Orleans, where many of the bodies are above ground because of environmental issues.
Right.
But it is about very much about status, you know, although many still will bury underground. And again, cremation has to factor in, since that is certainly a favored method of disposal for many of the wealthier classes.
Okay, Glenn is on the line. He's calling from Scroon Lake in New York. Glenn, does this kind of thing matter to you?
Well, I just have an observation about the Helmsley issue.
Sure.
If you believe in the concept of karma, that the things that you do tend to come back to you, it's interesting that the high-rises that they may have built in the past that have obscured the views of the living, how this issue seems to have come back to the Helmsley.
I see where you're going. Okay, you see a certain poetic justice in all this.
Well, I guess so, in a way, yes.
That's great.
Yeah, Gary?
I think that's hilarious. I mean, I think that it holds true. It'll come around to get you in the end.
but Xavier, one wishes no disrespect, but the idea that a tomb is entitled to a view, is it ludicrous?
It's a very good question. I mean, that's at the heart of the Helmsley thing. I don't know what the law is, but this is going to be fought in court, where the lawyers are going to be making reference to statutes. And the question is, you really would have to talk to somebody who, and there are people out there who are experts in cemetery law. And the question is, as I see it, that when they bought the mausoleum in the late 70s, whenever it was it per the contract with Woodlawn, did it say, you will not obstruct this view, you will not build anything on this field, which I think the architecture guy was calling it an abandoned entrance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's really a legal issue, as absurd as it sounds, in terms of, you know, the opinion of, do you have the right to a view if you've bought a mausoleum at a cemetery? I guess you could say yes. Why would you not? On one level, this is really not in my backyard story, right? It happens to be going on at a cemetery, and Leona Helmsley is one of these media figures that people love to read about, as you know, going back to the tax evasion story.
Sure. Let's go to the phones again. Peter's calling from Mason City in Iowa. Peter, do you think about what kind of view you might have when your time comes?
Well, Robin, actually, I do, and my view is going to be from the inside of an urn, or perhaps spread out into a lake, probably Crater Lake in Oregon. But anyway, besides that, I think the real issue here is what we're talking about is nothing less than urban sprawl at the necrotic level. And that's the real issue here, is that cemeteries are not sustainable. Not that I side with Leona Helmsley and her husband's privilege to exclusive view, but the bigger issue of when are we going to wake up to realize that the billions and billions of people that die, if we allocate land space to their burial, and we don't turn to a cremation or digging up after a few years like the Greeks do, because they just don't have the physical space to do it, that we're gonna run out of vital space for the living.
Okay, so it's a space issue then, as far as you can see.
Yeah, it's not sustainable. I see cemeteries going up, and the more people that die, I mean, you know, you're talking about the 6-7 feet, you know, plots, you know, that it just is going to exponentially take away from land from the living, and it's just not vital. I think we need to just rethink how we honor the dead. And there's no reason we cannot, I think it was Gary was saying, or was it Xavier, that, you know, we can shoot them into space, or we can put them on our shelf. Or one of the issues that I wanted to talk about is, why can't we take our beloved ones and send them off to a scientific laboratory and have their skeleton built up like they do in medical school and have them sitting over in your corner?
Well, whatever suits you, I guess. But, I mean, I like the idea that in cemeteries the same constraints apply. After all, American cities got their skyline simply because you couldn't build out, so they built up. Xavier, do you think that is, in fact, what's happening in the cemeteries? They're running out of space. They've got to build up.
Yeah, well, that's exactly. I don't mean to be promoting my other book, but my second, the book, the architecture book.
Go on, give it a plug.
Anyhow, it's called Grave Exodus, Tending to Our Dead in the 21st Century. It was published in 1996, and that was the exact theme of the book. The lead of the book is Americans are getting cremated. And, and I don't know what the data is like now, but essentially we went over a generation from about 5% of the population getting cremated to 20% plus. So what the caller said, I mean, that's happening, and it is happening in part out of necessity, because we're not running out of burial ground, but ask cemeteries when they try to get expansions, what happens? I mean, the local folks band together, and again, in another not-in-my-backyard situation. Mm. Part of it is changing mores, and the Constitution of the U.S. in the last 30, 40 years, I don't need to tell you, the huge influx of Asian populations, the Hispanics, the ethnic groups, I mean, from everywhere in the world. So the diversity of the U.S. makes it so that it's not a traditional 6 feet under, you know, to use the HBO show.
Right.
It's not a traditional, you know, grandpa dies, we're going to bury him in a casket in the local cemetery. I mean, those days are long gone.
Beth is calling from Oak Ridge in North Carolina. Beth, have you decided where you want to end up?
Oh, I certainly have. I have taught in medical schools, and one of the things that I'm going to do is donate my body for either to be a cadaver or for medical research. And I think this whole idea of a tomb with a view is just, it's really funny. I was talking to the caller about, or the screener about, Da Vinci and how he had to literally rob graves against the law to be able to learn and draw the anatomical drawings that we have from him today. And I think that it's invaluable for our students to have people who want to continue education after their death.
But it matters to family members often where the departed relative is. They wish to pay their respects. They wish to pay visits. Does that not matter to you?
No, it truly doesn't. Because, you know, like everybody else, I have relatives that are buried in graveyards all over this country. And, you know, I just don't get there to visit them. But I think to have my family know that a generation of medical students used my body to learn with is important. Oh, and one year my fourth grade teacher was actually a cadaver in the medical school I worked in, and the reverence those students gave her when I told them it was her was just amazing.
That must have been strange.
It was incredibly strange, and of course we don't have names, but I knew she had donated her body, and I knew when she had died, and what we have are descriptions of the age and what the person's occupation was and what they died of, and darn if that didn't just match completely.
Beth, that's an extraordinary tale. Thank you.
Gary,
coming back to the cremation issue here, that was the preferred solution to the space problem, if we can call it that. Now, I'm wondering whether the idea of community mausoleums gives people another option. You can't get into the ground. There just isn't space left. You can go for cremation or you can go for a community mausoleum.
And that's not all. There are other options as well. The issue about the environment and space issues is of great concern to many other people who want to find other options that are more environmentally sound, that may not be just cremation or some kind of entombment. There are movements around the country that relate to the green cemetery. And people also will take the ashes of their cremated remains home and put them up on the shelf. So there's a great variety of different options available for how we dispose of the dead.
But is the idea of the community mausoleum, I mean, we were talking the Woodlawn Cemetery one, 2,300 spaces available. I've seen reference to others where there were several thousand crypt spaces available. That, in a sense, I have the impression is the future.
It could very well be the future, again, especially in certain more congested areas of the country. I mean, I don't think this is an issue, as you heard earlier, in a lot of the rest of the country outside of the major metropolitan areas where the space issue isn't as pressing. But this, you know, like any real estate, as you were saying, is you can't build out, you have to build up. And I think the cemetery often follows social trends.
Pedigree? Penury in America's cemeteries is what we're talking about this hour. Is there a class war going on in the country's graveyards? My guests, Gary Lederman and Xavier Cronin, call us 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about tombs and status symbols. My guests are Xavier Cronin, author of Grave Exodus, Tending to Our Dead in the 21st Century. Also with us is Gary Lederman, who teaches religion and culture at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's the author of The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Towards Death. Gary, you were talking about options available, cremation, grave, mausoleum. Other options too?
Well, there are certainly other, as I said, movements that are looking for ways around tradition and especially finding alternatives that are lower cost. So there are do-it-yourself funeral options. People also for quite some time now have chosen memorialization ceremonies that don't really have anything to do with the dead being present during the ceremonies.
And is there now a growing interest, do you think, in, I suppose, what one might term non-traditional ways of dealing with death? I mean, are attitudes changing?
Oh, extremely. And I think Xavier had it right earlier, just in thinking about the composition of the country and how things have changed, especially since really the 1960s. So the diversity, the demographic diversity, is opening up possibilities that didn't exist before the 1960s. But there's also a great deal of experimentation and kind of interest in alternative religious systems, which also frees people up so they're not bound by their traditions to do what I think is probably the most sacred act that we all have to perform, and that is to take care of our dead.
You mentioned cost, and I'm wondering, I remember my Jessica Mitford, The American Way of Death, and her suggestion that the profit motive played a large part in how these things are dealt with. Cremation has obviously gained in popularity hugely in recent years, and the funeral industry makes a lot less money out of cremation, doesn't it, than out of burial. And I'm just wondering whether perhaps the mausoleum idea is more attractive to them as a profit earner.
Well, they're always interested in turning a profit, and I think whatever trends may occur, the funeral industry has shown itself to be very adaptable, I mean, within limits, so that they actually can participate and give the consumer what they want, but also continue to run their business.
You can get a lot of options available if you do want to go down the mausoleum route, can't you?
With certainly, in terms of what you decide to do in terms of, for example, visiting the grave, what kind of mourning practices you might want to engage in. Again, maybe just sitting and meditating in the presence in this, you know, huge lobby with all kinds of other bodies there, but at least being close by your loved one, you know, and visiting, meditating, whatever it is that you need to do.
Let's talk to Greg, who's calling in from Sumter in South Carolina. Greg, what are your thoughts about what one day will come to us all?
Well, personally, for me, I'm going to be cremated. I believe in that the body does return to dust, and, you know, there is, like you have said and the previous callers, there is more important use of the land that we can get, you know, with the amounts of people on Earth these days. I consider the whole thing kind of a moral argument. You know, I think it's real unfortunate that people are so selfish in life that once they're gone, they have to be selfish, too, about, you know, who's going to remember them. You know, what's important in life once we die is that our soul is with God and that we remembered by the life we led, not how much money we had and the monuments that we could build to leave behind. You know, every person is important as the next. Like Dunn said, no man is an island. On the same token, no man is a mountain. You know, no man's more important than the next. And I'm also a fan of I'm religious, but I'm also a fan of Darwin, and I believe that if the people want to get in these arguments, wasting money and on these monuments and you know, wasting all the resources fighting over each other on who can leave behind, fine, let them. I'll spend my money on my offspring and let them.
But I want to be clear, Greg. Are you saying that you have a religious objection or at least a moral objection to the idea of these community mausoleums?
I'm not saying I have a religious objection to them, per se, just that I have an objection with the status symbol of it, you know.
Right.
I don't have an objection with what people want to do. I have an objection that us as individuals should look at how important our life is compared to the person next to us and the person that can't afford to get into these mausoleums.
Okay, Greg, thanks for that. Gary, the phrase the Walmartization of the funeral business has sometimes been used in this connection. Is there a sort of homogeneity growing up here that, you know, the sort of the mass mausoleum?
It could turn into that. It remains to be seen how much this really catches on and appeals to people's sensibilities. I mean, I think it already has some legs, but as the earlier caller from the firm mentioned, it may have peaked already. And I think a lot will depend. I mean, it certainly got a lot of exposure in public media now through this case. But when you get down to it, across America, I would be more cautious than to assume that this is actually going to turn into that kind of trend.
Xavier, I talked right at the beginning of this hour about location, location, location. Is it your experience that people do care about where the grave is, where the mausoleum is, as much as what it looks like?
Well, unfortunately, part of it has to do with the relationship between the survivors and the dead. I mean, the truth is, if it's a cherished loved one, of course they want it to be a beautiful spot, a place where they can be reflecting on their life. So I think the idea also about the homogeneous nature of the community mausoleum, what people can do, even if they're in a very similar space, they will customize it with flowers or mementos or decorations. So, yes, we're...
But that's difficult to do if it's on level 5 or 6.
well,
this
actually,
is what I can't get my
head
around.
They have little step ladders from the ones... I mean, it sounds absurd, but if you want to be eye-to-eye with your loved one's remains... And it's at level 5, you literally have to get on a little ladder, and they provide those. I mean, I know what you're saying, but the point is they can still try to customize it, but at the same time, it is within this general, you know, nondescript concrete building where there's a In one case, I just wanted to mention that the largest that I'm aware of has 100,000 crypts in Los Angeles, a cemetery called Inglewood Park. So just massive, massive buildings. And that particular cemetery has what are essentially catacombs, underground crypts. I think there are several thousand of them.
I know that cemeteries are often called cities of the dead. That really is an apartment block of the dead. Let's talk to Carol, who's on the line from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Carol, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I love this conversation. I'm actually going to see my family grave today in Quincy, Massachusetts, and I get great comfort from going there. If I had my way, I believe with so many of the viewpoints of your callers, we'd all be cremated and we'd all be packed tightly underground in our little family plot there at Mount Wollaston. So I do see the need for space saving, but also as a graphic artist, I love looking around at some of the grand monuments of other people in the mausoleum, and I appreciate the art aspects of it and the whole history of the cemetery. That's my comment.
And the view from the crypt, from the mausoleum, from the grave, does that matter to you?
Well, actually, the cemetery has restricted the amount of mausolea that can be built. In fact, our own little family plot, we can only have flush markers now. So we keep the park-like setting there at Mount Wollaston Cemetery.
Okay, so you're on your way today to visit.
To plant flowers.
And do you find when you get there that there are many other people doing the same thing?
No, there isn't a big rush to the cemetery. I don't see busloads of people coming in. And, in fact, some of my family members think I'm a little weird because I like to visit as often as I do, which is perhaps only even once a month.
So, Gary, perhaps Leona Helmsley's fear that hundreds, if not thousands, of people are going to be tramping to the community mausoleum next to Harry, she may not have reason to worry.
That's right. I think it's not likely that there will be all of a sudden busloads of people running around the cemetery. I bet Duke Ellington and some of those other famous people who are buried there get a lot more traffic than this mausoleum is going to get. And people generally don't visit. Some do, and there are people like this caller. I take my death and dying class, to the Oakland Cemetery here in Atlanta, so they're forced to go. But most people, you know, don't generally go and visit their loved ones. Another interesting point, too, is the difference between what we would like to do for ourselves in terms of our funeral and what our loved ones want to do for us. I mean, there's usually a very great difference. And the funeral industry is sort of based on the notion that the funeral is for the living. And it is. And the survivors will make very different choices about how to best respect and honor the dead than I would do in terms of planning my own funeral.
Do the survivors tend to be more lavish in their wishes?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Generally, yeah. And it's also a fear. You know, you don't want to really upset the dead. And so you want to do as much as you can in our capitalist society. That's spend a lot of money.
The idea may be a little bit of guilt sometimes. I didn't do as much for them in life as I perhaps wish I had done, so now I will do a bit more in death.
A common argument. That's a common psychological analysis of it, but it's also, I think, a little more complicated.
Oliver is on the line from Putney in Vermont. Oliver, what do you think about this whole idea of public mausoleums and tombs with views?
I think it's a terrible waste of money and resources. I think if people want to honor their relatives who've passed on, they should donate the money they would have spent on a mausoleum, donating to some kind of research for medicine or something like that, or helping people learn to read. There's all sorts of things. I think that, I don't know if anybody's mentioned it before, but the Tibetans have a wonderful way of disposing of the bodies. They chop them up into bits, leave them out on a rock, and let the vultures eat it.
Let's talk to Damien, who's calling from Rochester, Massachusetts. Damien?
Yes, an interesting alternative to the mausoleums would be to do what they do in the Azores. I visited my wife's island of Piku in the Azores, which is a very small island, maybe about 8 miles across, and it's been inhabited since the 1300s, and they don't have a lot of burial space. So what they do is after about 50 years, they'll dig up a grave and then just put a new corpse right on top of the old one, rebury it, and put a new marker on it.
Okay, fine. Mary is on the line from Kerry in North Carolina. Mary.
Yes, I'm going to speak quickly. I just have several comments. One is I'm delighted to speak to Robin Lustig because when my local station turned to All Talk, you were the first one that I heard.
Oh, well, how about that?
BBC News, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Second of all, I would like to see something like gardens built out of cremated remains. I would like to be returned to the planet from which I have taken so much. But I also wanted to mention that my choice, I think, would be to first donate to science or medicine and afterwards be cremated. And I want to be put in a blue mason jar and launched at sea.
Okay, Mary, thank you. Well, on the subject of choice, Gary and Xavier, you've been with us this hour. Let me ask you about your choices. Xavier, have you decided what you want?
You know, actually, I haven't. I guess I'm like a lot of people that, you know, in middle age, I just haven't thought about it. But cremation, I mean, it's just, it ultimately is one of the most personal decisions you make as far as I see it. But yet, cremation, it's just a combination of religious beliefs and one's worldview. And so cremation for me.
Okay. And Gary, where do you want to end?
Well, did you see the recent funeral ceremonies for Ronald Reagan?
Mm-hmm.
I would like something like that. Mm. A big, you know, parades on both coasts, and I'll be embalmed and put in a casket. I have no idea exactly what I'll do, but I thought those were pretty magnificent kinds of ceremonies.
Well, I hope your family members are listening into the show will take due note of your wishes. My thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Gary Lederman, author of Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. He joined us from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Xavier Cronin is the author of Grave Exodus, Tending to Our Dead in the 21st Century. Earlier, we spoke with Andrea Pesa of the New York Post and with Barry Boudreau, Senior Manager for Cemetery Design at J. Stewart Architects. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Orit Kuritsky-Fox, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.